Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Frank Stacio. Robin Young is on vacation. It's Here and Now. There have been more explosions in London, England today, 2 weeks to the day since the bus and subway bombings that killed at least 56 people and injured more than 700. Like that attack, today's incidents involved three subway stations or trains and one bus. Details are in short supply, but one clear difference from the earlier attacks, there is only one reported injury today. One witness at the Oval Street Underground station described seeing an apparent bomber fleeing the scene.
We all got off on the platform, and the guy just ran and started running up the escalator. Everyone was screaming to stop him, for someone to stop him. He just ran past me, and I kind of stood in one of the alcoves, and he ran out of the station, but he left a bag on the train.
Prime Minister Tony Blair later called for calm.
We know why these things are done. They're done to scare people and to frighten them, to make them anxious and worried. Fortunately, in this instance, there appear to have been no casualties. The police have done their very best, and the security services too, in the situation. And I think we've just got to react calmly.
Joining us on the line from London is Here and Now's Michael Goldfarb. Hello, Michael.
Hello, Frank. How are you?
Well, I'm okay. The question is, what do we know now about these latest attacks?
Well, sometime around 1:30 p.m. local time, there were four explosions relatively simultaneously, as happened 2 weeks ago on the 7th of July. The Metropolitan Police Commissioner Sir Ian Blair characterized them as explosions or attempted explosions at the Oval Tube Station, Shepherd's Bush Tube Station, Warren Street Tube Station, and on a bus in Hackney near Columbia Road, which is the scene of a very charming flower market every day. And just to correct the Prime Minister, there does seem to have been one injury in these incidents. Now, the transport system was closed down. The people of London were asked by the police chief to stay where they were, and that stand down lasted for a few hours. And then at around 4 o'clock local time, a kind of all clear was given, and those parts of the underground that could still operate were started up again. There is currently an incident going on at University College Hospital, which is probably 100 yards from Warren Street Tube Station. A man is being pursued by police. There was an initial report that that incident was over, but it has resumed, and a number of police have returned and are searching the hospital for this man. And at Shepherd's Bush, the bomb squad is examining the train there. Apparently, there was a suspect package left behind by someone. And also on the bus, a knapsack has been found on the upstairs of this double-decker bus, and the bomb squad is going there to see what this is. But whether it's something that somebody just left behind in the panic to get away, or is a bomb that did not go off, it's not clear.
What do we know about the nature of the devices themselves, the ones that went off today?
Very little. There's a report that there was some white powdery substance on the bus in Hackney. And, of course, you know, white smoke and white powder is indicative of a chemical blast or a chemical agent being at work. And the police have been very quick to check on whether this is a chemical attack of any kind. They say it absolutely is not. It may have been residue from acetone, which was used, we're told, in the bombs 2 weeks ago. Again, not confirmed and not entirely clear.
And not clear either if the devices that went off were the intentional devices, or if they were somehow parts of other devices that were that could have caused much more damage. In other words, these do seem to be small explosions today.
They were small explosions, and it's still too early to tell whether it was just an intentional disruptive action. This is the sort of thing, by the way, that the IRA used to do when it was in the midst of its serious bombing campaign on the British mainland. What would happen is there'd be a big event, like 2 weeks ago, and then a series of aftershocks in which the methodology was similar, but the bombing impact was smaller, but the effect was the same in terms of disruption of life in London.
Is the transportation system running now?
The transportation system is running now, except the underground lines, the tube lines that were affected. So the Northern Line, the Victoria Line, and the Hammersmith and City Line are not working. And of course, the Piccadilly Line, which was the underground line that suffered most damage 2 weeks ago, is still out of order.
Now, the Times of London reported that radical cleric Omar Bakri Mohammed had promised more attacks recently. Have authorities pointed to him in any way as possibly connected with these attacks?
No, they haven't. And Omar Bakri Mohammed, a man whom I've interviewed on several occasions, is never one to miss an opportunity to stir up the pot. But, you know, he's been on the air still, and he still speaks freely. And that was his view, that there were more people willing to carry out this kind of attack in Britain.
There was an arrest of some kind at 10 Downing Street earlier today. Any idea what that was about and whether it's connected to these bombings today?
That's still not clear, Frank. Those were quite dramatic pictures. A man was, it's not quite clear whether he was simply making some pretty loud and comments at the gates of Downing Street. Downing Street now has thick, heavy metal gates which face into Whitehall, which is the main street that runs through the government area in London. And you know, people pass by and they hang on the gates rather as they, you know, look through the gates at Buckingham Palace to watch the changing of the guards. Now, whether this guy was simply making a nuisance of himself and screaming abuse at Tony Blair, which on other days happens, but today was just the wrong day to do it, is not clear.
Not clear. Here and now is Michael Goldfarb in London. Michael, thanks so much.
Thank you, Frank.
In Iraq, Sunni members of the committee to draft the new constitution have withdrawn from the process after two Sunni colleagues were assassinated this week. That move adds to doubts the committee will agree on a constitution in time for a scheduled vote in the National Assembly in August. This comes as a new Pentagon report indicates that Iraq's police force is ill-prepared to battle the insurgency, with at least half of the police units still in training. Bush administration officials repeatedly have said that American forces can't withdraw until Iraqis are ready to take charge of their own security. John R. Quillett is a defense analyst at the Navy Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. We spoke with him recently and asked, if U.S. forces can't leave now and staying in the country puts them at risk, is there another option?
Oh, I think so. As you say, if we leave precipitously, there'll be a bloody civil war. If we stay as we are, we will encourage more insurgency and terror. So what to do? Bill Clinton would call this triangulation. Can't leave, can't stay in full. So how about sending part of the troops away? And I've recommended in a recent article that at least two-thirds of our troops could be reduced, in part because the enemy is relatively small in numbers, is limited to passive actions like improvised explosive devices, some sniping, and of course some suicide bombing. But it's really not enough to overthrow the new government that we've put in place. So with very small numbers of troops, we could keep a very, very good order there. In fact, drawing down our force might encourage the bad guys to come out in the open where we could fight them a little more easily, such as when they attacked Abu Ghraib prison and over 100 of them were killed on the spot. So smaller is better here, and what it will also do is reduce the antipathy that the Iraqi people have for the American forces occupying their country.
Well, the big complaint that I've heard most often from the military, who have complained out loud about the U.S. Occupation so far, is that there aren't enough troops, that if you want to really squash this insurgency, you have to take it seriously and double the number of American forces.
Well, if you did that, you'd have more targets for the insurgents to hit. Look, we've tied down 17 brigades there. If there were a crisis in Korea or somewhere else in the world, we would be absolutely crippled. So it doesn't make much sense to me to put more troops. But again, if you ask your average Pentagon general, do you need more troops? He'd say, sure, I do. How many have you got? And this was true in Vietnam and elsewhere. It's the response of those who don't want to fight in a different way.
Well, let me pick up on something else you said. You said the insurgency so far is not enough to bring down the new government. If the U.S. reduced its troop strength, wouldn't they be able to build to that point?
Oh, not at all. If the insurgents tried to increase their military capacity, they couldn't do that without our detecting it, and that's when we'd be able to strike at them. See, the more troops we have there, actually, the easier it is for them to start the firefights. A while back, they were starting as many as 90% of all the firefights. We began to move to a little bit more networked approach in different parts of the country, and now we're starting at least half of the firefights with the insurgents, which is a very good and healthy sign. In this kind of warfare, particularly against distributed networks, less is more. The more troops we have, the more they're in the way.
You have talked about this idea of reducing American troop strength, pulling them out of the cities, putting them in the background where they can do more reconnaissance and intelligence work. And I saw an Associated Press report last week that suggested, it quoted a secret British Defense Department study, that said maybe the Pentagon is considering a similar idea. Have you seen any signs that an idea like this is under serious consideration?
Well, all I can report on is that I've had discussions about this idea inside the Pentagon. I can't comment on classified documents, but that British report suggested that the American reduction was going to take forces down by a little over 60%. I suggested 2/3. Hey, close enough for government work.
In many ways, I can hear critics saying that the plan you suggest is just another way of saying, let's declare victory and pull out.
Oh, not at all. The third of our troops that we would leave would stay there indefinitely until the problem was clearly settled. See, the other issue we have to deal with is that even if we do win in the field and leave, as long as there's one al-Qaeda operative left, he'll declare victory. So this is how I've adapted my thinking. We've gone into Iraq. We've gone into Afghanistan. We've got to be in both those places for a very long pull. But how much of us has to be there, that's the third way. It doesn't have to be a huge field army. It can be a small overlay of special and very networked American forces.
Yeah, but that raises the question, how do you know you've won? When is it finally over?
Well, I think there's all kinds of indicators in the country. One of them is the number of terrorist incidents, which obviously we're not doing very well in Iraq there. The other is the opinion the people hold of us. And the day Baghdad fell in April of 2003, half of all Iraq saw us as liberators. By June of the year we handed over to the provisional government, only 2% saw us that way. We won every firefight and lost the battle of the story. We've got to go back in that battle of the story and do far, far better. And, of course, we have to deal with the insurgent cells. Those are the measures of victory.
Well, when it comes to the story, Donald Rumsfeld wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, and he essentially seems to suggest the best way to understand what's going on there, to get the story, is not to listen to the media. What he suggested in that op-ed was that you go to the Defense Department website and you will get the real deal about the war there and elsewhere. You're a very big part of the defense security community. There's a lot of information that you see, and I wonder if you agree with Donald Rumsfeld that the news media is the problem and the Defense Department is the place to get accurate information.
I could not disagree with the Secretary more. I think that a well-informed public is the basis of sound national security policy, and that the media are an essential part of presenting an accurate picture to the people.
Defense analyst John Arquilla of the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. We'll continue our conversation in a moment and find out if the current U.S. strategy is an effective defense against terrorism. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Frank Stacio. It's Here and Now. Continuing our conversation with defense analyst John Arquilla, before the 9/11 attacks, he co-authored a report in which he urged the U.S. to shift its defense strategy to battle terrorist networks rather than nation states. We asked John Arquilla whether that advice has been taken.
Well, we're now nearly 4 years into the first great war between networks and nations, and unfortunately, we're still thinking in terms of nations. Our biggest responses have been to go into Afghanistan and to Iraq, which are other nations. And we've only, with very mixed results, been going after the network in various places around the world.
All right, and let's talk about the changes that you see that need to be made. Let's start with the terrorist organizations. Are they still a global network?
Oh, al-Qaeda is very much a global network. In fact, before we invaded Afghanistan, they were much more regionalized in their hub in Afghanistan. But since we took that sledgehammer to the ball of quicksilver over there. They have spread out all over the world, and in fact, they're more dispersed, more distributed, and harder to track than ever.
Well, this gets to something you said very early on in your analysis. You really thought that going into Afghanistan was a bad idea. Do you still feel that way?
Well, I think that dealing with al-Qaeda's haven in Afghanistan was important, but I don't think we had to take down the Taliban as well. At least half of the members of the Taliban didn't much care for bin Laden or al-Qaeda, and there was a way for us to reach out to that half that was unfriendly to bin Laden and basically to get them to betray him and hand him and his minions over. That would have been a lot easier than the kind of campaign that we mounted, which ended in his escape at Tora Bora and the creation of a new haven inside Pakistan.
So this created this this smaller but more dispersed network that you're talking about.
Sure. In effect, we forced al-Qaeda to innovate, to become harder to find, harder to track, and harder to defeat.
Is it a true network in the sense that there is any kind of central command, central authority, or is it a completely regional kind of a network?
Well, networks tend not to be centrally controlled except in their large ideas, and that bin Laden does maintain with his vision of a war designed to reduce the shadow of American power on the Muslim world. There's also a great deal of direct contact between the New Haven in Pakistan and various cells around the world, but nothing like command and control as the Americans conceive it. Bin Laden might just say, I'd like an attack in this country by the spring of 2006. Go do it.
How do they communicate?
By email, basically. They know to stay off their satellite phones, and so the web and the net become very, very important. They meet in chat rooms. They send material in spam. I'm not allowed to say a lot of the other things that they do.
I understand that websites are also a part of this communication network.
Oh, very much so. Al-Qaeda is extremely sophisticated. Sometimes they'll have websites up simply for an hour or so, and the goal is to log on to that site, figure out which icon to click on, which will transport you to another site that may be up for just a short period of time. And, of course, all functional information, that is about finances or battle planning and such, is very highly encrypted, so hard, even when it's intercepted, hard to break into. The unfortunate part for us is that the $40 billion we spend on intelligence is mostly going for satellites and systems for listening to phones, and the enemy is moving in cyberspace in ways that we're simply not prepared to go after.
Well, but the Internet's kind of a leaky, wide-open space, isn't it? Isn't it easy to find people?
For al-Qaeda, the benefit of the vastness of cyberspace is that they can move in ways that are very hard to track, although a clear effort to try to get at this was undertaken by Admiral Poindexter with his Terrorism Information Awareness Program, which, because of its vague Orwellian undertones, was killed. So probably the best thing we could have been doing was stopped. And in the meantime, instead of networking ourselves, we've created two huge new hierarchies in the Department of Homeland Security and the National Intelligence Directorate. Wrong moves.
Well, wasn't one of the complaints about our intelligence gathering ability the fact that these intelligence groups, FBI, the CIA, they weren't talking to each other. Somebody had to kind of take charge and centralize. Couldn't that be a good thing?
Oh, no. We've just created new places for information to go and die. Every time you add new layers of hierarchy, you make it worse. Networking means lateral connection. Allow people to talk directly with each other at the field level. And frankly, a lot of that is going on at the grassroots. The best thing we've done institutionally has been to have the president sign Executive Order 13355, which calls precisely for this kind of cooperation. But again, just as in the Pentagon, they're resisting transformation to a military of small distributed units, so the intelligence and law enforcement establishments are highly resistant to this kind of change.
Is there any indication that there are some planners, as we talked about smaller units, and looking at networks as the problem rather than nation states, any idea that anywhere else in the bureaucracy this idea is taking hold?
Sure. There are a lot of places within the military and the intelligence community where we are actually building hunter networks. They are deploying to many places around the world. And in the last 4 years, we've preempted about 100 attacks, torn apart a couple of terror networks in Africa, in Chad, Algeria in particular. Here was just a thin overlay of American intelligence and military force working with locals, with our network affiliates, if you will. We're building a network to fight the network. But this is just a very small part of the overall effort. We're spending over $1 billion a day on our military and intelligence apparatus. And only a thimbleful of those resources are going to the networks that are most potent against terror.
John Arquilla of the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. Our thanks to public radio station KAZU in Monterey for their help with this interview. Tomorrow on Here and Now, New York Governor George Pataki orders greater oversight of the state's Medicaid program after the New York Times details massive fraud. We'll talk with one of the reporters who looked through Medicaid's records and found, among other things, a dentist who claimed she'd seen more than 900 Medicaid patients in one day. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Frank Stasio. It's Here and Now. The Bush administration today welcomed an announcement by China that it will no longer link its currency to the U.S. dollar. Officials in Beijing said China will allow the yuan to float within a limited basket of currencies. The U.S. has been pressuring the Chinese to adopt a more flexible system as part of an increasingly intense trade dispute between the two countries. Joining us from Shanghai is Peter Goodman, Asian economic correspondent for The Washington Post. Hello, Peter.
Hi.
The U.S. has been pressing China for a long time now to allow its currency to float. Does this mean that the Chinese are sort of giving in to the U.S. Point of view?
Well, no. It doesn't mean that. China has said for a long time quite consistently that it wants to do this. It eventually wants to move to a floating exchange rate, meaning let the whims of global traders determine how much one yuan is worth compared to other currencies, and that it would do that on its own timetable according to its own interests. However, the timing of this clearly seems intended to help ease trade tensions with the United States. China's President Hu Jintao is scheduled to visit Washington sometime in early September, and the fact that they've announced this now seems clearly to indicate that this is something they want to do, but it's a good time to do it in the hopes of making the relationship with the U.S. better.
All right, and let's explain this for us. How does allowing the yuan to float help the U.S.? Why would the U.S. like to see that happen?
Well, that's a question people in China are asking. I mean, the view here is that this is largely a domestic political issue in the United States, and that there are very, very few ways in which the value of China's currency affects the U.S. economy in any significant way. The effects in China are quite significant because this could effectively jack up the price of Chinese labor. It could jack up the price of raw materials for China. And that could have impact in terms of how people in China manage their own businesses. But the U.S. now is sitting on roughly $162 billion trade deficit with China. And most economists, both here and in China and in the U.S., think that the only real way that deficit comes down is for China to start buying more goods from the United States and exports from China, which will presumably get a little more expensive as the value of China's currency goes up, don't really weigh that heavily in the balance of trade with the U.S. The real issue, if China's goods are a little bit more expensive on the world market, is will American consumers buy T-shirts that are made in Mexico or the Philippines instead of T-shirts that are made in China? It's not as if there are all these factories in America waiting to go back into the T-shirt business, a business we've largely exited.
Well, I guess that's the key point, that if the price goes up because the value of the currency goes up, it doesn't mean the textile mills all of a sudden come back online in North Carolina.
Yeah, I don't think a lot of people in America will be jumping back into the toy business or the furniture business as a result of the fact that China's currency just went up by about 2% on world markets, with the possibility of a further increase down the line.
Now, explain this, too. This is a little broader question, but the Chinese have something like $500 billion in bad loans, but we also hear that they're awash in currency. They're holding all of this U.S. debt. How do those two things match up? Can't they pay down some of this with all that cold cash they've got?
Well, this is really the great story of the Chinese economy. Yeah, the banking system is, by all accounts, insolvent. There are bad loan ratios of depending on who you believe, 40, even 50% of outstanding loans. But they're swimming in money, and they're swimming in money in part because their export growth has been so dramatic, in part because they've managed to attract more than $100 billion in foreign investment over the last couple of years, and that investment has gone into very fast-growing parts of the economy. So there's a lot of cash cycling through this economy. It's been lent out in many cases badly over the years. It's been lent out to prop up state-owned factories that don't make any money, that are essentially, their job is to simply keep people working in the old state economy. That's happening less and less, but there's still an awful lot of corruption that goes into lending. So what China has tried to do is keep the economy growing fast enough to keep this transition from communism to a free market system less painful than it might otherwise be, creating new jobs in the private sector without, slamming the brakes on growth, which is what people here fear would happen if all of a sudden they just radically change the way they lend money.
Getting back to something you said earlier, according to the Chinese, the way to address the trade imbalance is not to make Chinese goods more expensive in the United States, but to somehow make U.S. goods more attractive to the Chinese. What is it that we're selling to the Chinese, and how could those goods be more attractive?
We're selling sophisticated technology in some cases. We're selling airplanes. Boeing is doing a great business over here. We're selling simple commodities like pharmaceuticals, toothpaste, detergent. Kentucky Fried Chicken, KFC, is one of the most successful American investors in China, and they're bringing in much of their goods. The U.S. is the largest provider of cotton to China. So a lot of these textiles that we've been arguing about in America coming in from China are being made with cotton that's originally grown in the United States. And what Bush administration officials have said, quite frankly, is this $162 billion deficit, it's not going to come down because all of a sudden China moves on its currency and its goods are so much more expensive on world markets that we start using our own products at home. That trade deficit could come down if barriers to American products that are reaching China are brought down. This is really the ultimate goal of the Bush administration in terms of managing the trade relationship with China.
Peter, I'm not sure if there's any connection between the value of the Chinese currency and the Sinuk deal. That's the attempt by the Chinese energy company to buy the U.S. oil company Unocal. But could any of this affect the outcome of that deal?
Well, it could. It certainly changes the feeling of the relationship between China and the United States, and the currency issue has been the biggest sticking point in that relationship. There are a lot of issues. We've seen arguments over surges of cheap Chinese-made textiles reaching the United States since the lifting of a global quota system at the beginning of the year. We've seen some claims in Washington that Sinuk's attempt to buy a U.S. oil company, even though Unocal controls about 1% of the American oil supply, constitutes a threat to U.S. national security. But the biggest sticking point has been this currency issue, with the Bush administration and trade groups and members of Congress claiming that China's currency regime makes it an unfair trading partner. There's been talk of sanctioning China for alleged currency manipulation. A bill's been moving through the Senate that would slap punitive tariffs across the board of 27.5% on all Chinese-made goods if they don't revalue the currency. So if this move today takes the currency issue off the board, or if it mutes some of the rhetoric, then yeah, presumably that changes the climate in which Sinuk has to operate.
Peter Goodman, Asian economic correspondent for The Washington Post. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks very much.
Still to come, visiting the sites where rock stars have died with author Chuck Klosterman. You're listening to Here and Now. The U.S. Congress has told Major League Baseball to clean up its act on steroid use, but will it? That's one of the questions asked by journalist Howard Bryant in his new book, Juicing the Game, Drugs, Power, and the Fight for the Soul of Major League Baseball. Bill Littlefield of NPR's Only a Game recently spoke with Bryant and asked him to explain why, by the 1990s, players felt they had to juice up to play the game.
There was a feeling in the mid-90s, and certainly it had peaked by 99 and 2000, where players believed that they had to use these substances in order to compete, that even a player who wasn't interested in performance-enhancing drugs or was scared of steroids, or it simply wasn't conducive to the type of style of game they played, believed that they needed to compete, especially the players on the margins where the difference between the major league minimum salary of $300,000 and the maximum minor league salary of $10,000 a year was so great. Mm. The players recognized that if the guy next to me is doing it, I have to do it because you don't get any gold stars for being virtuous.
After the embarrassment of the lost World Series in 1994, baseball recovered its popularity, at least in large part, because of all the home runs Mark McGwire and Sammy Sosa were hitting, the daily battle between them to see who would break the records. Did managers, general managers, and the commissioner ignore the steroid problem because the home run was so good for business?
I don't know if that's the real answer. It sounds good, and I actually tend to agree with it at some level. What I really think happened was that coming out of the 1994 strike, when attendance was down 28% in 1995, when the commissioner and every single baseball team in the league had been receiving thousands upon thousands of letters from diehard fans that said, "I'm never coming back to this game after you canceled the World Series," that baseball was so paralyzed by the concept of another scandal that it simply did not want to police itself on this. It did not want to find what it was going to find. I don't believe that this was an active conspiracy where Bud Selig and Don Fear and some baseball owners got into a room and said, "Hey, this is the way for us to recover." I think that they simply did not want to confront a problem that people in the clubhouse had been aware of at least since 1996-97.
Jason Giambi acknowledged that he had used steroids, and he was welcomed back by crowds at Yankee Stadium on opening day. Barry Bonds, who's acknowledged using a steroid cream, albeit allegedly unwittingly, and has otherwise been linked to steroid use, got a standing ovation in San Francisco on opening day when he hobbled out to get his MVP award. Do fans care whether players use steroids?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, to me, that was one of the central conflicts of the book. And this book does not pretend to have all the answers. What I really wanted to do was to ask a simple question. What were the reasons for the greatest era of offense? Why did it happen now? And you've got two major conflicts here. On the one hand, you've got these retired players. You've got Mike Schmidt and Reggie Jackson and Joe Morgan and Jim Bunning saying that anyone who uses steroids should... Their record should be wiped out. On the other hand, you've got the commissioner of baseball and a very important set of facts. And those facts are as follows. More fans came to the baseball stadium than ever before. They've broken attendance records in consecutive, numerous years. You've got TV ratings higher than ever. You've got the commissioner of baseball saying that, beginning with Cal Ripken breaking Lou Gehrig's record, continuing on to Sosa McGwire, continuing on to Barry Bonds and Cubs Cardinals and this Yankees Red Sox resurgence, and now to last year with the Red Sox winning the World Series, that this period is a renaissance. And it's hard to argue with him when you look at the raw data. So my question, and the question that I try to pose to anyone who reads the book, is which vision wins out? Are we in this moral quandary where the retired players and where a lot of people who are on this side believe that the game has been tainted forever? Or do you fall on the side of the commissioner where you say, "Hey, what's the problem?"
Howard Bryant writes for the Boston Herald. He's the author of Juicing the Game, Drugs, Power, and the Fight for the Soul of Major League Baseball. He spoke with Only a Game's Bill Littlefield. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. Frank Stasio. It's Here and Now. All right, here's a little quiz for you music buffs out there. What do all of the recording artists in this scramble have in common?
Living for today. That'll be the day when I die. This is our last goodbye.
Call the coroner. There's gonna be a lot of slow singing and flower bringing if my burglar alarm starts ringing.
Bad folks gonna die.
That's right, they're dead. And they died young. In his new book, Killing Yourself to Live, 85% of a True Story, Chuck Klosterman recounts his three-week road trip across America to the sites where famous musicians Kurt Cobain, Elvis Presley, Duane Allman, and a host of others met their untimely demise. He sets out hoping to discover why, in so many cases, the greatest career move in a musician's life is a premature death, and what that tells us about our society. Along the way, he explains 85% of his love life and opines about everything from what makes Rod Stewart a great singer to how Radiohead's 2000 LP entitled Kid A actually predicted 9/11. Chuck joins us on the line from his office at Spin Magazine in New York City. Hi, Chuck.
Hello.
Nice to have you on the program. The prologue to your previous book, Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs, A Low Culture Manifesto, you write that the goal of being alive is to figure out what it means to be alive. I just happen to prefer examining the question through the context of Pamela Anderson, The Real World, and Frosted Flakes. So I'm wondering if, like that book, this one seems to take that same tack.
Well, I suppose it doesn't, now that you mention it. I've never really dawned on me, but while the idea of being alive is present in both books, I suppose the death of Kurt Cobain and the guys in Lynyrd Skynyrd and Bob Stinson and 100 people in West Warwick, Rhode Island, probably is a little more substantial than Frosted Flakes or Pamela Anderson.
Yeah.
The initial plan with this story, because this began as a story in Spin Magazine that was expanded into a book, and our initial idea, me and my editor, was that maybe I should just go to all the places of any import that have a relationship with rock music, you know, just places that are interesting. That kind of raises the question, like, what is interesting? Is ZZ Top's barber, is that interesting? Is, like, you know, Madonna's gynecologist, is that interesting? You know, you get in this position where you're trying to figure out what has meaning and what doesn't. Mm. And as I was compiling these locations, the only ones that always seemed interesting were the death spots. And that became what the story was. It has to be something that really is meaningful. And death is the most meaningful element of life.
Were there any insights? Is there a kind of a unifying theme in all of these places, in all of these artists?
Well, here's what I found. You know, you're going to some place, like, say, Duane Allman, for example. Mm-hmm. Going to the place where Duane Allman died in Macon, Georgia. He died in a motorcycle accident at this little intersection. And another member of the Allman Brothers died at the exact same intersection in a very similar accident. So as I'm driving to Macon, I'm thinking about the music of the Allman Brothers and playing the music of the Allman Brothers and wondering what this coincidence signifies and wondering how the death of Duane Allman injects his music with a different kind of meaning. You know, what is the metaphoric value of a motorcycle when you put it in the context of a rock star's demise? You know, does this change or kind of almost create the meaning of how we view Southern rock? I'm thinking of all these things as I'm driving there. And then when I get to the spot, I realize it's a road. It's just a road where something happened. All the meaning is interior. I mean, you know, what can you really learn from someone's death? I mean, you learn basically what is important to you. I mean, this is ultimately rock criticism through the prism of my life. It's really a memoir. So the things I learned are things about myself, and hopefully people who read the book will have some sort of relationship with it, you know?
Well, there's a quote in the book. You know, it's about relationships and women as well. And so at one point you imagine that your car is slowly filling up with past and present love interests who take turns criticizing you, as it turns out. And one of them says at this moment, "You don't understand love or death. You compensate by becoming inappropriately obsessed with both, and probably for the exact same reason, you're conflating unlike idioms in the hope that you will accidentally take on, that they will take on symbolic meaning." So is that what you found?
Well, that's definitely what I was
thinking. Did you write all of that? Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, that happens in a place where I'm listening to Derek and the Dominoes. As I drive, I listen to mostly classic rock, and I'm listening to the song Layla. And, you know, Layla ends with this beautiful piano coda. It's like a two-part song. Mm-hmm. And the person who wrote that song was actually the drummer in Derek and the Dominoes, and he later suffered from really severe schizophrenia and ended up murdering his own mother. Mm-hmm. And somehow when I learned that fact, that music took on a different meaning to me, unconsciously. Suddenly the beauty in it, I saw all this sort of, I heard this tragedy and this weirdness, and it was almost like, boy, I'm hearing the artistic mind of a schizophrenic murderer. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes I realize, like, how ridiculous is that? It's the same piano plinking I'd heard my whole life. I'm the one who's deciding that this death of this poor man's mother somehow makes it more interesting as opposed to tragic, because that's how it is with celebrities. In everyday life, a death is tragic. In celebrity life, you know, it's interesting.
Yeah, but isn't that part of it? I mean, isn't that what the meaning is? Isn't that sort of trying to get at how minds work? And if you take a look at a healthy mind and then you take a look at the creative output of what turned out to be an unhealthy mind, gives us an insight.
Well, probably. I mean, you know, the fact of the matter is, the one unifying element among all people is that we're going to die, and we're all aware of it, okay? We have this shared knowledge that life is finite. But we can't go around thinking of that. We can't constantly dwell on the fact that our life is limited. If we did, life would seem very depressing. I mean, you actually, you know, they always say, like, live every day like it's your last. That would never work. You'd spend all day emailing people, telling them you love them, and calling your parents and thanking them, and quitting your job, because who cares about money if you're going to die, you know? So we compartmentalize the knowledge of our own death. And everybody does this. But when a celebrity dies, that information that's hidden away in our mind, we can manifest itself through them. We can think about our own mortality and our own sort of purpose in life by thinking and, I suppose, culturally mourning someone like Kurt Cobain.
I guess. Although I like what you said earlier, the idea that if we really did embrace the notion that, yep, we're going to die, we'd all love everybody and give away our money. That's utopia. You're on to something, Chuck. Chuck, can you read something from your book?
Okay. This is one of the things I was thinking about when I began driving through Montana. Thomas Jefferson is, hands down, the coolest president in American history. Now, this is not because he wrote the Declaration of Independence, although I will concede that has merit. Thomas Jefferson is history's coolest president because of the advice he gave Meriwether Lewis and William Clark before they explored the Northwest Territory in 1804. One of the many things that Jefferson warned Lewis and Clark about was mastodons. "You dudes need to watch out for potential mastodon herds," he told them. I'm paraphrasing, of course. "If you see any mastodons, make sure you tell me about them, because I need to know." Tragically, mastodons had become extinct 10,000 years before the expedition started. However, this is still solid advice. I mean, I'm taking the same path Lewis and Clark took, more or less. But nobody told me to watch out for mastodons. Where's the love?
Well, it's a great read. Chuck Klosterman, senior writer at Spin Magazine, a columnist for Esquire, has written for the New York Times Magazine, the Washington Post, The Believer, and GQ. He's the author of Fargo, Rock City, and Sex, Drugs, and Cocoa Puffs. His new book is called Killing Yourself to Live, 85% of a True Story. Chuck, thanks for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Come as you are, as you were.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Frank Stachow. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. On the web at mathworks.com.